Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Wisconsin Council of Religious and Independent Schools says under this plan, private schools would be graded based only upon the voucher school students they enroll. She says that's only one segment of the population in most private schools.
Often a small segment, often a segment with academic challenges, which would render a distorted picture of student learning and achievement for the entire school.
The effects of Senator Olson's plan would be gradual. It would take at least 6 years before a school deemed failing could be forced to close and reopen under new management. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Twin waterspouts put on a spectacular show over Lake Michigan yesterday afternoon. The waterspouts were sighted a couple of miles off Kenosha. Sergeant Bill Beth of the Kenosha County Sheriff's Office says that the two waterspouts merged into one large one, then split. The waterspouts popped out of nowhere, according to Beth. The National Weather Service says waterspouts generally happen between August and October. Warning sirens were activated about 1:45 in the afternoon, but nothing was hurt and nobody was hurt, injured. The U.S. Coast Guard searched Lake Michigan after witnesses reported seeing a sailboat disappear, but nothing of the sort was found. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Gail Ambrosius Chocolatier, Von Steel Winery, and Green Bay Symphony Orchestra. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Monona State Bank, a locally owned community bank specializing in mortgages for first-time and existing homeowners. With local decisions and local servicing, Monona State Bank is committed to being Dane County's home for home mortgages. More at mononabank.com.
Well, we have a jam-packed week in review, from developments over Syria to the anniversaries of 9/11 and Benghazi, to raw milk debates at the state capitol, to planned protests at the Packers football game this weekend by Native Americans who say the Washington Redskins' team name is derogatory. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on this Friday the 13th. September 13th. Don't be afraid to call in to talk about the issue in the news this week that you want to talk about, and please introduce a topic that caught your attention too at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are happy to have with us two new Week in Review guests. Every week we hear from two guests from different perspectives, and we're always looking to expand the number of voices you hear on this show. One voice you have heard on Wisconsin Public Radio many times over the years is columnist Eugene Kane, and we've been hoping to have him join us more frequently as a regular Week in Review commentator in addition to the times we hear from him on the topics that he's writing about. We are happy that he has agreed to join us today. Eugene Kane is a columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. His writings appear Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Good morning, Eugene.
Good morning, Joy. I have to admit, I didn't realize it was Friday the 13th, though, so you got me kind of freaked out now.
It's going to be okay. It's going to be a lucky day. Also joining us for the first time on Wisconsin Public Radio and on the Week in Review is Julian Bradley. He is chairman of the La Crosse County Republican Party. He is also the party's vice chairman of the 3rd Congressional District. He also happens to be a former professional wrestler and a former Democrat. Julian, good morning.
Hey, Joy, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. That's really a colorful biography, and we're not going to be able to talk about all of it, but I did want to have you mention something about your tour that you're going on next week. This is in part how you came to our attention, that you are expanding, continuing your shadowing stereotypes tour. What do you mean by shattering stereotypes?
Well, as many people know, the traditional stereotypes that have been kind of plaguing political parties are that, especially the Republican Party, is not a party of minority inclusiveness. And I am of mixed race. I'm half black. My father was black, and my mother was white. And so, therefore, just by inclusion, I want to get the message out that that is not the case for the Republican Party. I talk a lot about the history of the party, when things, you know, may have changed, especially the perception. And then my personal journey, I identified as a Democrat until really 2002. And then I changed parties, and I've been very proud Republican since. And I talk about my journey and you know what it was like for me to join the party. You know, I came in believing a lot of those stereotypes and feeling that I may not be welcome in the party because that is the perception, and that's not what I've experienced at all at any level. So I think it's important to talk about those issues. I've been traveling since April to really get that message out. And try to open people's minds to really look more at the issues and less at the stereotypes.
And we did put a link to your Shattering Stereotypes website on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page so people can check that out and see where you're headed next week. And I wanted to also mention, Eugene, that one of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you this week because you're one of your most recent columns was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and it was entitled President Barack Obama, Just Like Those Other Guys. And we decided, well, let's ask Eugene to talk about that some on our Week in Review. What makes you wonder that, Eugene?
Well, that column was in particular about the president's proposal to bomb Syria. And I think what I brought out is that I don't really think most of the people who voted for Obama saw him as a president who would get America into another war with another country. In fact, I think a lot of the hope and change they're betting on with Obama is that he would change the game completely in terms of being a president who has to always use threats of force and missiles to get things done instead of diplomacy. And at that time, I think, you know, my attitude was that he's turning out to be just like all the rest. Since then, it's been a week since that was last Sunday's column. I'm encouraged to see that I actually think there is more hope now on the issue of bombing Syria. But I wanted the column to show that everybody talks about everybody, particularly African Americans, are blindly loyal to Obama. And what I found, like polls have found among all Americans, most African Americans were not on his side in terms of, at least according to these polls, and then the majority of the Latino Americans weren't either. So I think that was good to show that, you know, he was clearly the choice of a lot of people, Obama, but when it comes to making war, just like I think most other citizens, people were not convinced that it was necessary to do that.
Well, let's move right into some of the most recent developments with Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart are meeting in Geneva today to discuss Syria. The two and other leaders are monitoring this brokered deal that Syria should give up its chemical weapons to avert a U.S. military strike. So, Eugene, you are hopeful about this this Russia-Syria deal?
Yeah, you have to be hopeful because I think with the knowledge of, and a lot of us still have the knowledge of Iraq so many years ago, and the build-up to Iraq was just so similar to what seemed to be happening in Syria in terms of the government making its case why this foreign country has these dangerous weapons of mass destruction, and the only way we can really keep them in check is to start some kind of aggression. Now, it's clear to me what Putin did, I think it was spurred by Obama's declaration, and it sort of got everybody's attention. So at this point, I'd be very shocked if they still feel the need to go ahead and do the missile strike, particularly since Russia has apparently decided that even they, you know, don't want to see it happen and have come up with a likely solution to them.
So, Julian Bradley, what about you? What's your take? Are you hopeful that this deal will work out, or do you think there's still going to be the possibility of military involvement?
Well, President Obama's address was quite confusing because he you know, mentioned asking Congress for a delay and a postponement in taking the vote on military action, but he still called for military action. So that was kind of a confusing message to the American people. But I agree. I really do hope that this works out, and I wish that all diplomatic efforts had been exhausted prior to a call for immediate action. I think it's important that we do learn a lesson from things, events that have happened in the past, and one of those should be, I mean, President Obama won a Nobel Peace Prize. It should have been absolutely exhausted before any even threat of war came out. But I am very hopeful. I do hope that it works out and that we're not engaged.
How do you rate the president's handling of this crisis so far, starting with Julian?
I think that what happened, the use of the chemical weapons is not disputed. We know that that's happened. And I think that President Obama may have reacted immediately more emotionally than, you know, taking a step back and saying, okay, what steps can we take that will not involve us in this region's civil war? And that's what I wish he would have done, and I'm sure there are many others that would agree that, you know, we need to take a step back and say, well, wait a minute, before we get involved into something that's likely to lead to or could lead to, you know, more war that involves the United States, we need to still go for peace. We need to try to talk it out. We need to send the Secretary of State over. We need to go through our allies. And we need to try to come up with a compromise to get, you know, the chemical weapons out of there without having to commit American forces, whether it's, you know, troops on the ground, which he said that would not be the case, but even missiles or anything else. So that's what I think would have been the best. It's easy, obviously, to be an armchair quarterback, you know, and watch and say, well, you know, it'd be nice if he had done this or that. But if I had to grade it, I wouldn't think he did well, especially in the address this week. I found it to be very confusing as he's, you know, laying on a case. We still need to do this, but we don't need to act now. We're going to try for this. I think as president, as commander-in-chief, it would be nice if he would just lay out a clear vision. This is what I'm hoping to accomplish.
All right. Eugene, what is, from your armchair, what do you see?
Well, in terms of how he handled it, I never kind of assume that I know everything that the President of the United States knows. I think that's a safe thing for everybody. I think that we might not know 70% of what the actual facts are. But I do think, based on what has been put out there, and because now they're stepping back from the missile strike, and it could possibly lead to some diplomacy that rids that region of the chemical weapons, I think Obama is, you can't underestimate him to a large degree. If all that happens, he will have done a good job, because I think what he did with the threat was to sort of carry the big stick that everybody talks about as America. And I'm sure his military advisors gave him ample reason why he had to sort of put the world on notice, we might have to do this against Syria. And again, I always think strategically, if you're really going to do something like that, I'm not really sure what the value is of telling everybody ahead of time, unless you want to put that person on notice so they can start acting right. So again, I think strategically, we don't know everything, so it's hard for me to actually grade what he's doing. I was disappointed that he even brought up the aspect of first making a military strike. But at the same time, that certainly got their attention. So,
Eugene, what was your reaction to Russian President Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times this week, ripping the U.S. for getting militarily involved in foreign conflicts? He said it's hurting our image in the international community. He also said it was dangerous for a country like the U.S. to think it's exceptional. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the editorial, I read it. My sense was that on one level, it's kind of humorous when you take the context of who's supposedly writing it. The phrase, the pot calling the kettle black, comes to mind because, I mean, you got the leader of one of the most oppressive regimes in the world scolding America. And my sense was that what was even more amusing was all of the people, particularly Republicans, opponents of Obama, who suddenly are praising Putin for being, you know, some great savior and telling them that he schooled Obama and just heaping praise on this guy who I believe the godfather of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan, once called, you know, Russians the evil empire. So it's just weird to me that some people will go to such lengths to criticize Obama. They end up embracing this guy who might be head of one of the most evil countries in the world. So, again, the letter, it seemed actually reasonable up to the point where he starts taking all these shots at the United States. And then if you actually take into context Russia's history of civil and human rights oppression and their crackdown on gay citizens, I mean, it's really hard to take him seriously. But yet, a lot of people in America, important people, seem to use that op-ed to raise Putin up to the level of Obama.
So, Julian Bradley, are you embracing Putin?
No, and I don't think a lot of – look, I don't think – bottom line, we're all Americans, Republicans, Democrats, regardless, we're all Americans. And it does our nation no good to have another world leader scolding us on a very, you know, world and public stage. Did I vote for President Obama? No, I did not. But that doesn't mean that I don't want him to be successful during his term, because that's what's best for our nation. So, no, I don't think it's good that that Putin was out there and scolding our president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. I don't think that that's helpful, because we still have to work with other nations on many other issues. Once Syria passes, there will be something else, whether it's a trade agreement in the future or some kind of treaty. Things come up. It's never good to damage the office of the President of the United States. He did raise some valid points, but I don't think it's, you know, great to question whether we believe we're exceptional. I'm sure many nations believe they're exceptional. That's kind of that home team mentality. And of course, I believe America's exceptional, and I'm sure, you know, many Americans do. But no, I don't have him up on a pedestal of any kind. And I think that kind of thing is, you know, it reflects how the president handled this conflict by calling right for immediate action, military action, rather than, you know, going right to a diplomatic solution.
We will take some calls on the latest developments with Syria in just a moment as our week in review continues. We'll also move on to other top stories in the news this week. We'll touch on the anniversary of 9/11. It's also the anniversary of the Benghazi attacks occurred this week. We'll talk about top state news issues, including raw milk. A raw milk hearing on whether or not it should be legal to sell raw milk in Wisconsin. And if you have an issue in the news that you want to bring up, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine talking with our two Week in Review guests making their Week in Review debuts, Julian Bradley, chairman of the La Crosse County Republican Party and the party's vice chairman of the 3rd Congressional District, and Eugene Kane, columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. His writings appear Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network.
Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and I'll be hosting a 10-day tour with Holiday Vacations to Hawaii this March. Garden highlights include a pineapple plantation, coffee and lavender farms, botanical gardens, an orchid nursery, and a whole lot more. You can get a brochure from Holiday Vacations at 800-826-2266 or online at holidayvacations.net, keyword Wisconsin.
Support for WPR comes from American Folklore Theater, presenting the musical Victory Farm by Emily Colson, singer-songwriter Katie Dahl, and composer James Valk, playing through October 19th at the Door Community Auditorium, Fish Creek. Info at folkloretheater.com. Support also comes from Drs. Laura Tills and Matthew Cutts of River Place Dental, offering general dentistry for the entire family and committed to creating a comfortable first dental experience for children.
Learn more at riverplacedental.com.
Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up this afternoon between 3 and 6, it's Central Time. After 5, Veronica Rickard and Rob Ferret will talk with the authors of Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. And they will also look at the Native American mascots controversy and also get some tasty tailgate recipes. It's Food Friday on Central Time. That's coming up today after 5. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives. Today we are happy to have with us Eugene Kane and Julian Bradley. And we also welcome your input in the news stories that we're discussing at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lots of callers. Let's go first to Pat in Richland Center. Hello, Pat. What do you think?
Well, good morning, everybody. I think that everybody in America should give Barack Obama a great big thank you for getting some wisdom and some decency in the White House finally. Look what he did. It's so obvious. Put some wisdom in this thing. He said, okay, we'll attack Syria with some missiles, and then he throws it out there and tells the Congress, you go ahead and give me the okay for it, and the American people give me the okay for it. And then they go on an eight-day recesses, and the Congress, they're not going to give them the okay because the American people are so much against this, okay? So Barack took a chance there, and now the future leaders of America can say, hey, look, you know, this war thing, America's had enough of it. Barack went on TV, on the news shows, trying to say we should do this missile attack because it's a moral and ethical thing to do, and got rejected anyway, and so... You know, this is kind of the opposite of George the First's speech saying America has finally kicked the Vietnam syndrome, which meant, of course, American people's reluctance to do military action.
Yeah, so
and this man what's is your point, amazing.
Pat? Yeah, so you Pardon? Think you think that Obama averted war by threatening it?
It's what Obama did was give the American people and the Congress. It's only 10 years ago that Bush and Cheney and those guys did every lie and square tactic in the world to get the American people to go along enough to do this war. Barack gave the American people and Congress a chance to reject it soundly.
All right. We get you. So he wanted us to decide, Eugene Kane?
Yeah, I do agree that was, in a lot of ways, it was a, I don't say a brilliant move, but it was an effective move because he did put the onus on Congress. And I think compared to the way the Iraq War started, there were, you know, people in the administration who were basically making the case to the American people that we had to invade Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. They created a furor where if you went against that, you were considered unpatriotic at the time if you went against the Iraq invasion. This clearly was a different tact, and I do think the caller is right. I think Obama realized that when you put it all on Congress, then they're going to have to make a lot of real tough decisions themselves, and I think he realized a lot of politicians in D.C. aren't really up to making tough decisions right now.
Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee now. Hello, Nate.
Hi, thanks. I was going to point out that a couple things. First, with Syria, I think Barack might have been caught or trying to react to things as they changed because he was going to make this speech, I think, before the diplomacy option on chemical weapons appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And so he moved to move with that. I would also point out that the difference between Syria and Iraq is that there were people in Syria in large numbers who I think were calling out essentially for the U.S. to intervene. And now we're in a situation where the U.S. has war fatigue. Whether or not it's right for us to intervene, we don't necessarily want to, and I think al-Qaeda understood that because part of the reason they were gaining popularity in Syria, at least among some, was that they were saying, we'll help you and the West will not. Now, at some points, the West has tried to say something, and even if we end up with a diplomatic end, one of the things that I think Obama potentially rightfully said is that whatever diplomatic end we get to, at least the chemical weapons, comes in part because we were able to say that we'll do a punishment for some atrocity, and we were willing and able to follow through on it.
All right. Julian Bradley, your reaction to that?
I'd like to kind of respond to that first one, too. I don't think, you know, hindsight is one thing, but I really don't think this was the president's plan. I think the president wanted to take immediate action, and now we're reflecting back on a very confusing, you know, week and some change between the rollout and the call for action, the call for action, he wants action, I'm going to ask Congress, another world leader steps up, publicly scolds the president of the United States. You know, I don't think this was a brilliant plan. I think this is just how things are playing out for the president and on the world stage. I can't fathom a situation where the commander-in-chief of the United States would put himself in that situation to be, you know, publicly scolded and have our nation damaged by somebody saying that war is our first action. Eugene mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of the hope and change that came about with President Obama's first election was that, you know, we weren't going to be a war-first country. We were going to be diplomatic. He was given the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, prior to really having done anything as president. So I just want to address that. I absolutely disagree that this was some kind of brilliant plan that's working out the way it was drawn up.
I think, Bill, you mentioned hindsight. I think you have to agree that that if he avoids the military strike and diplomacy works and we step back from the brink, if we're using hindsight, then looking back, you could say that it worked out the way he intended it to. Nobody knows that for sure, certainly, but that's what I meant, that it could turn out to be a brilliant strategy.
Well, we're gonna...
I think that he intended, I think that he intended to seek a military strike, and I'm basing that just on what he said. I think the consequences of his intention are what we can look back on and say, well, at least that worked out, and we didn't have to go to a military strike.
We are going to move on to some other issues. Lots of callers who want to talk about Syria, but for new listeners' benefits and for our guests who are new Week in Review guests, we touch on all of the top stories in the news internationally, nationally, and in the state of Wisconsin during these Week in Review shows. So need to move on. This week also marked the 12th anniversary of 9/11, 12 years since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and 1 year since the Benghazi attack. President Obama vowed to defend the nation and said that force is sometimes necessary, but he says that it should not be the only option. Meanwhile, also this week, the number one guy in Al-Qaeda is calling on Muslims to attack the U.S. and bleed the U.S. financially. So, Julian Bradley, how real is the terror threat today?
I think we have to take any threat as real. You know, none of us on this call receive security briefings, so we don't know, you know, what level of danger and we have people that we trust to try to protect us and keep us safe. And whether, you know, we agree with some of their decisions politically or not, we do have to hope and pray that they are doing that. It's scary. This is a scary world. Nobody thought, you know, when 9/11 happened that something like that could happen. And we don't know what other threats lay out there. I'm just, you know, very hopeful that the agencies and the men and women that are charged with keeping us safe are you know, wide awake, and they're taking every threat seriously.
Yeah. Your thoughts 12 years after 9/11 and 1 year after Benghazi, Eugene?
Well, certainly September 11th, when you recognize 12 years after, you see how many ways it changed society, starting with something as basic as air travel and the increased level of security that we live under now when we're traveling, when we're in public spaces. I mean, that is just something we're going to have to deal with for the foreseeable future. I don't really pay much attention to Al-Qaeda bluster because they've been sort of making these kind of threats every year, and every year there's a September 11th anniversary,
And there have been attacks overseas, but none in America, which I think is a sign that they're doing a good job of protecting us that way. I'm a little peeved that they bring up Benghazi along with 2001 9/11, because that shows me a total lack of proportion. The two events are really nowhere similar in terms of the catastrophic effects from the attack and the loss of life involved and its impact on society. So I understand that Benghazi became a big Republican talking point for people to bash the president, but to link it with 9/11 2001, I just don't see any equation there other than people just wanting to make a statement against Obama. Mm-hmm.
Julian, you have a reaction to that?
I think what happened in Benghazi is a very big deal. It's not just a Republican talking point. People were murdered, and I don't know of an instance where murder, especially, I mean, we're talking about, you know, diplomats that were brutally murdered in Benghazi, and we're still waiting for answers on this. This isn't just a Republican talking point. I resent that.
Waiting for on Benghazi?
I'm sorry?
What answers are we still? There have been investigations, hearings. From my point of view, a lot of the questions posed to Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration about Benghazi have been answered.
So we know exactly what spurred it and why we were delayed in reacting and why the president's language was confused about what may have caused it. I mean, I guess I'm still wondering what some of those answers are. We absolutely can't just write it off. Well, that happened. You know, we need to make sure that not just us at home, but our diplomats that are serving, you know, across the world are safe. We need to make sure, you know, we keep Americans safe. That's not a Republican talking point. If it is, well, thanks for reinforcing why I'm proud to be a Republican.
You know, there was another, there was an ad that ran in the Madison area. You probably didn't see it, but Eugene Kane, what did you think of this Madison area golf course that apologized this week for advertising a deal of $9.11 for nine holes and commercializing the event?
Well, I thought it was clearly a case of a company where people sit around and brainstorm in a room and the boss comes up with a pretty ludicrous idea, but nobody in the room is brave enough to say, hey, boss, that's kind of stupid. So, and I mean, I don't blow that out of proportion because there have been, I saw at least one other 911 advertisement ad campaign. I think it was actually run by a newspaper. So that can happen. I remember people used to get upset when people would run special sales on Martin Luther King Day. So That's a separate thing, I think. But it was a boneheaded move, and the golf course owner apparently realized it was a boneheaded move, although he still tries to kind of wipe it off. So
yeah, he was the price went back to normal, but then he said he would donate the difference to some sort of charity. People were raging mad about this, and the club got some death threats. A quick reaction from you, Julian Bradley.
I agree with Eugene. I think people overreacted. Death threats over this is certainly an overreaction. I think it was distasteful, but. And I definitely agree. I can actually visualize people, you know, sitting in the room and the boss saying, "We've got this great idea for a marketing gimmick. Let's, let's charge $9.11." But it's distasteful, yes. Warranting death threats or anything like that, absolutely not.
We have some callers. Dan in Milwaukee, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Dan in Milwaukee.
Right. What was your point?
9/11 2001 was a lot. It was people that had no understanding of any danger, whereas in Benghazi, the diplomat knew of the danger that it posed to leave a protected embassy to go to an unprotected consulate. It was a tragedy, but he was not an unknowing civilian. He knew security risks. He knew the threats. He knew the day he was going to be in the consulate. It's not the same thing in any equation.
Thank you, Dan. Let's go right away to Randy in Key Wascom, who has another take on Benghazi, and then we'll get our guest to conclude. Randy, go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Well, the thing is, people at the consulate called a number of times and asked for, they asked for more security a number of times. It was refused. And this whole deal, the administration, who made the decision to lie to the American people for an inordinate amount of time? I mean, they were coming out and saying this was just spontaneous when the it's been shown that they knew already that it was a terrorist. No, it was spontaneous. So who made the decision? Who made the decision not to send them more security when they asked for it? There's a lot of unanswered questions, and they don't want to address it.
All right. So, Eugene, those are the unanswered questions, according to Randy, anyway.
Yeah, I know, but my point is that if you follow what's been reported, one of the top military people has disputed that anybody was told to stand down, that they were refused help. And again, in terms of the time context, this, to me, happens so quickly that it just gets absurd to sort of think that the United States was going to be able to react in real time to what was happening. I call it a fog of war incident. You could even go more military and call it a FUBAR, because obviously something was messed up in terms of the response. I think there was clearly mistakes made in trying to figure out exactly what this demonstration, deadly protest was spurred by, but I don't think there was any obvious intention of people to lie to anybody. And that hasn't been proven. So to make those accusations when people have basically stepped up and denied it, I mean, I don't see that as evidence of anything.
Mm-hmm. Julian?
Well, we still have, I think this brings a great point. We still have to answer the question of how these mistakes were made. These are the questions that are unanswered. What can we do in the future to avoid those mistakes? You know, 9/11 happened. And then what did we do? We tightened up airport security, and we took a lot of measures to make sure that something like that would not happen again, at least the same way. Until we answer the questions regarding and surrounding Benghazi, we don't know what we can do to avoid it in the future.
Julian Bradley is the chairman of the La Crosse County Republican Party. He is the party's vice chairman of the 3rd Congressional District. He is also a former Democrat. He's a former professional wrestler, and he is going to be kicking off continuing his Shattering Stereotypes tour across the state next week. You can see more information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And Eugene Kane is also with us. He is columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. His writings appear Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We are happy to have both guests making their weekend review debuts with us today. We're going to turn our attention to some other state and national issues after this break, plus the weekend review quiz. This is the Weekend Review on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, helping healthcare professionals put their skills to work in the wake of a disaster through Weaver, Wisconsin's Emergency Assistant Volunteer Registry. More info available at weavrwi.org.
Support also comes from Epic in Madison, giving patients online access to their health information through their web-based MyChart software. More information and career opportunities at epic.com.
Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, it's 45 North. The Midwest Gypsy Swing Festival is celebrating its 11th year this weekend at Art in the Barn. Joining 45 North in studio is Gypsy Swing Band Harmonious Whale. That's coming up on 45 North after 9 o'clock. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Eugene Kane and Justin Bradley, and it is time now for our Week in Review quiz. Overshadowed by the latest developments with Syria and the anniversary of the September 11th attacks was an announcement about the Olympic Games. Which city was awarded the 2020 Summer Olympics? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and we will offer the winner a book that we featured on the program recently. Now, just take the next 5 minutes or so to call in or email in your answers. We're going to stop taking your calls after that. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. All right, well, let's move on to state news. A federal judge this week ruled that Act 10, the law that stripped most public workers of most collective bargaining rights, is constitutional. Workers in Madison and Dane County allege that the law violated their right to freely assemble and that it imposed wage limits on union employees, but none to non-union workers. Well, the judge said that the law lets them assemble and speak, but he said that the law says the employers do not have to listen to them. Did he get it right, Justin Bradley? Oops, are you there,
Julian?
I'm sorry, Julian.
That's okay. I think that the law that passed, I'm not surprised by the judge's decision. The law that was written and it passed both houses and was signed by Governor Walker was constitutional. The governor inherited quite a rough situation rather than Lehman's predecessor. He got to work, and he said he learned many lessons from the way things were handled regarding Act 10. But, I'm not surprised that it was upheld as constitutional.
Mm-hmm. Your reaction, Eugene?
Well, I'm not really surprised either, because I know the way when you put in the hands of these activist judges, it depends. You never can predict what's going to happen. My thing about Act 10, I see it almost as the state version of Obamacare. And that Obamacare, even though everybody wants to complain about it, it's a law. You have to deal with it. And it's the same thing with Act 10. It seems if it continues to get approved going up the ladder, I guess they're going to try to go all the way to the highest court they can. It will be the law, and people have to deal with it. I think the real problem, some people and a lot of people in Milwaukee, and particularly people in unions have, is, again, the way it was presented. I think there's no question Governor Walker sort of just kind of pulled this and put it on people without campaigning on it. And that is I think that's what causes most resentment. It was like he just sort of surprised us with it and then pushed it through. That will always be, the main center of controversy over Act 10. The fact that if he had campaigned on this or let public have their say beforehand, I don't think he ever would have had the guts to try it.
Another passionate issue in Wisconsin that made headlines this week is the raw milk debate. There was a public hearing this week on a bill that would legalize the sale of unpasteurized milk, more of a farmer directly to consumer type of thing. Supporters are saying that this should be legal, that raw milk is healthier for you, that it tastes better than pasteurized milk, but opponents say that that's not so, that unpasteurized milk is unfit for human consumption, and that it would also damage Wisconsin's dairy brand should there be some sort of sickness outbreak. Where do you stand on whether or not raw milk should be legal, Eugene Kane?
Well, I don't know about Julian, but I'm a born and bred city boy. I don't think I have any clue as to what the real debate over raw milk versus pasteurized milk is. I'm not sure what raw milk would even taste like, but as a city boy, I'm pretty sure I'd shy away from a glass of raw milk. So, but to be educated about it, I think there seems to be some good points on the side of people who wonder whether it will impact on the way. This is America's Dairyland, so that makes it important to consider what you're actually allowing people to sell. But again, I think the debate over raw milk might be slightly out of my wheelhouse.
Yeah, and Julian, what about you?
I'm also more of a city boy, but I am a little bit familiar with this debate. And look, as Eugene said, this is America's Dairyland. We have to preserve the integrity of our farmers and the products that we put out, and we also have a responsibility of protecting our citizens as well. So if there are health and safety concerns, those need to be addressed. If we can provide, you know, raw milk in a very healthy and safe way, I'm absolutely in favor of it.
Well, how about this? First Lady Michelle Obama was in Wisconsin yesterday. She was at Watertown High School, and she was making the case to drink more water. The White House chose Watertown as the place to launch this effort because the goal is to make every town a water town. So, Julian Bradley, is it good for the White House to be encouraging us to drink more water?
I think it's great that we should all be encouraged to drink more water. I love water.
No, all right.
I don't think that's a political issue. I know it's made the news, especially here. I think it's great for Wisconsin. You know, a visit from the White House will help the local economy. People are going to come in. They're going to spend money. So as far as that goes, yes. But, you know, that's like encouraging people to breathe air. It's very important, and we should do it. And I would encourage everybody that can to do it.
Yeah, what about even though it wasn't the focus, that you should drink more water and maybe therefore you're going to be drinking less soda pop?
Water is still good for you. That's my primary beverage. You know, I'm fine with the encouragement. Like I said, it's an encouragement to do something healthy. I don't think it's outside of her role to encourage us to be healthy. I don't think it's outside of anyone's role to encourage you to be healthy. You know, we don't want to micromanage people's lives. But I think it's good, especially for kids, to see, you know, the First Lady come out and say, make sure we drink more water.
Yep. And do you drink enough water, Eugene Kane?
Yeah, I try to, Joy. I won't say what I drink it along with all the time, but my attitude is that Michelle Obama, I think a lot of people really see her as a fine First Lady, and they're dismayed when she gets people take shots at her. And I don't know what Julian was listening to in your neck of the woods, but here in Milwaukee, there were several commentators and bloggers who made it a political issue as though, oh, well, why is Michelle Obama traveling to Wisconsin to talk about drinking water? This is just showing how the Obama administration can't really do anything right. And they found a couple scientists who questioned, you know, the science of drinking water. So that was my only disappointment, that once again, because it's Michelle Obama, because it's the Obama administration, you hear criticism of a first lady when every first lady has these smaller campaigns during the time their husband is in office, and they do this kind of stuff all the time. But it does get political when it's the Obamas.
I don't think it's just Obama. I think President Obama or the Obama family, I think it has to do with the money spent, you know, traveling to come say, hey, drink water. You know, you can Skype in. Let's use technology. It's 2013. We can Skype in and we can say, let's do this. The Obama administration does a lot online. They do a lot of YouTube videos and at whitehouse.gov. I think, you know, money better spent rather than taxpayer money would have been maybe a little campaign focused on the Internet, which is what children use most, kids use most. You know, reach out to people in that way. I think that's where the only political discussion is. But I personally don't see it as a real political issue. Water's good for you. We should drink it.
I want to get both of you to react to a story that a couple of pollsters, including Marquette University's Charles Franklin, this week said that Governor Walker is vulnerable in 2014, primarily because of the economy and job creation in Wisconsin. So, Julian Bradley, do you think that Governor Walker is vulnerable in 2014?
I think there's no guarantees in politics. You know, as a supporter of Governor Walker, I will be doing my part to ensure that he is in a position to be reelected. I think whenever you have a candidate that's, you know, come out without officially coming out and is, you know, willing to invest such a large amount of personal money and not following the process of politics, and they're playing stories and meeting with people, I'm running, I'm not running, you know, that certainly is something the governor, you know, is going to be aware of and needs to be concerned with, because there's a process for a reason. There's rules, and we need to follow those rules. If you're going to be a candidate, you need to register before you start doing polls, for example, or doing ads. And anybody that's willing to spend over $100,000 on a school board race is going to, you know, raise any concern. So I don't think there's any slam dunks. I don't think there's any guarantees in politics. And I anticipate that the governor will be running for re-election just like he's running for election the first time. He's still hungry. He still has a lot that he wants to do here in Wisconsin, and I look forward to being a part of that.
Yeah. Do you think Governor Walker's vulnerable, Eugene Kane?
Yeah, I think whenever just about half of the electorate doesn't approve of your policies, you have to be vulnerable. But the thing is, it was the same situation during the recall. That was really the time for people who wanted to defeat Walker to kind of turn out and show that they wanted to change things, and they couldn't get the numbers. So now Walker's an incumbent, which I think gives him even more strength. I think it'll come down to picking a challenger who excites people and gets that energy back that they really feel that they have a chance to get someone whose policies they might see as destructive to them out of office. So, of course, he's vulnerable.
Yeah, so Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch says the Walker administration is still working hard at creating 250,000 jobs in his first term. The most recent Department of Workforce Development report shows that Wisconsin added only 84,000 jobs since Walker took office. So, Eugene, do you think that Democrats should push hard on this issue during the election?
Well, certainly. If you're a politician who dares throw out a number and make a promise like that on something as important as jobs, if and when you fall short, you should be called on it. So, you know, I never understand why people come up with these numbers anyway, unless they've done enough study and enough research to be relatively confident. And at this point, it doesn't really seem very confident that Walker will reach that number in his first term.
Yeah. Julian, your thoughts?
When Governor Walker was running and for governor for the first time prior to the recall, we were losing, you know, about 133,000 jobs. We have now gained 84,000. That is an absolutely incredible turnaround. Are we shy of the goal of 250,000? Yes. But to those 84,000 families that have been positively affected by the governor and his policies, I think those families and their friends and their communities will take notice that we are moving in the right direction. We need to keep moving Wisconsin forward. And that's what, you know, a Walker win in 2014 will do.
Quickly running out of time, but some members of the Oneida Tribe of Indians are planning on protesting Sunday's Packers-Redskins game, saying that the nickname Redskins is offensive. Very briefly, Julian Bradley, do you think Washington ought to drop the Redskins name?
You know what? I'm actually a native. I was originally born in Baltimore. Moved when I was a child, so we had the Skins, and you'll notice I called them the Skins. Growing up, I didn't realize that was offensive, and times have changed. At one point in my life, I probably would have said, well, it's just the name. But now, you know, you find times change and words change. The word Negroes was a common word at the time, and now it's very offensive. I think it's time that Washington and the team catch up to our times, and we need to adapt. If this is offensive to the nation, to the natives, then we need to adapt. We need to change that name.
Eugene Kane, less than 30 seconds.
Well, I have family in Bowie, Maryland, who follow the Washington pro football team, and I think that's the best way until the owner decides to change it to refer to that team. And I'm glad to see very prominent sports writers have decided they're always going to call it the Washington pro football team and not that other name.
Thank you both very much for being with us. It's been a great hour.
Thank you, Joy.
Eugene Kane and Julian Bradley, our guest for the Week in Review. Congratulations to Stephen O'Clair. He's the winner of the Week in Review quiz. Which city was awarded the 2020 Summer Olympics? It was Tokyo. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
From one generation to the next, Wisconsin families have entrusted their children to Wisconsin Public Television and its family of friends on Sesame Street, Curious George, and Thomas and Friends. Its nonviolent commercial-free programming educates and inspires children. Check the website at wpt.org for detailed broadcast information.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Sheboygan Tourism, celebrating Oktoberfest October 4th and 5th, an opportunity for an all-German experience in the Brat capital, complete with polka and schnitzel. Information at visitsheboygan.com.